Remember when teenagers spent every spare moment gossiping on AOL with code words like OMG and LOL? That is so yesterday. Those teenagers are now millennials. They'll inherit America from the baby boomers who raised them, and the country will change radically as they do. Paul Taylor of the Pew Research Center says millennials are well-educated, tech-savvy, and socially aware. They're also less white, less Protestant, and less loyal to institutions than their elders were. Unfortunately, they're also underemployed and could be the first American generation less affluent than their parents. With boomers counting on Social Security and Medicare, benefits many millennials think they'll never see, Paul Taylor worries about generational warfare unless we rebalance the social compact that binds young and old. He joins us next on Midday after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodrigues here. Thanks again for joining us for our second hour. There's an old saying among social scientists that demographics are destiny. If that's true, the future of the United States will certainly be different from the recent past. The nation is growing older and more diverse than at any time in its history. In his new book, The Next America, Paul Taylor of the Pew Research Center also notes that it won't be long before people of color, blacks, Asians, Latinos, and others, will be a majority. Their support helped elect the nation's first mixed-race president twice. Marriages between racial, ethnic, and religious groups are on the rise as millennials, the generation now turning 30-something, seem more willing to abandon conventional fault lines of race, religion, and politics, as well as the institutions that support them. Paul Taylor notes that millennials are better educated than their forebears, and technology is part of their DNA. They're more likely to vote for Democrats and don't hate big government, but they're also more libertarian, self-reliant, and entrepreneurial than boomers. Unfortunately, they reached adulthood in a country struggling with a recession and structural changes in the economy. Many are underemployed, living with their parents well past the age when their parents had moved out and established families. Paul Taylor notes that millennials have few prospects for the kind of unionized manufacturing or white-collar jobs that allowed many boomers to join the middle class. In fact, he says millennials could be the first generation of Americans who are less affluent than their parents. What makes this so troubling, Paul Taylor argues, is that the baby boomers who raised those millennials are retiring in record numbers. They're depending on Social Security and Medicare at a time when there are fewer workers left to support a growing number of retirees. Many millennials doubt they'll ever enjoy the old age safety net their parents have. Will they be willing to keep the social contract alive? Or will generational warfare produce another fault line in our fractured political system? Paul Taylor is Executive Vice President for Special Projects at the Pew Research Center, the nonpartisan think tank that conducts public opinion polls, demographic research, media content analysis, empirical studies of all kinds of things, generational, economic, political, religious, lifestyle issues, all kinds of things. We use Pew Research Center as a source here in our show. Before he joined Pew, Paul Taylor held top assignments as a foreign correspondent and political reporter for The Washington Post. Growing tired of the traditional political game, he quit the Post to start a group that persuaded the networks to donate airtime for Bob Dole and Bill Clinton to speak directly to Americans. That was during the 1996 presidential campaign. He later served as president and chairman of the Alliance for Better Campaigns. Paul Taylor is the author of two previous books, and his latest is The Next America: Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. It's available from the Public Affairs Press. Paul Taylor, thanks for joining us here on Midday on WYPR.
Boy, thanks for having me. And, you know, I've been doing media for the last month or 6 weeks since the book came out. I think that's the most fulsome and best introduction I've heard. I feel like I should be asking you the question.
Well, credit to my producer on this, Michael Himowitz, who helped me with this script today. So, Paul, here we are, and I need to just go over a couple things with you. For those who aren't quite up to speed on what a boomer is and what a millennial is, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Let's get that part out of the way. I said, I know that boomers are born between 1946 and 1964, generally. That's what we call a baby boomer. Millennials, though, maybe we need to be a little more specific there.
Sure. Well, we the Pew Research Center defines millennials as anyone born after 1980. So the oldest of them would be now just turning 33, 34. We don't know when that generation ends. We tend to, when we do our surveys, we tend to concentrate on adults. So for the sake of this discussion, these would be young adults ages 18 to 34. The next generation up are the so-called Gen Xers. They're now in their mid-30s to late 40s. Then, as you say, the boomers born in that big baby boom right after World War II. The youngest of them is 50 or so. The oldest is 67. And 10,000 baby boomers a day are crossing the threshold into old age and starting to collect Social Security and Medicare. This happens every single day between now and the year 2030 and puts pressures on these programs in ways that you described.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the oldest of our generations is the so-called silent generation. The youngest of them is in his or her late 60s, and they go on up to their 70s and 80s. And so four adult generations and more to come. There's a 12-year-old who's different from the millennial generation. We don't know quite what to call him or her yet, but presumably they will declare themselves at the appropriate time.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for doing that. And the numbers are impressive here. We're going to focus on millennials and baby boomers here. And the numbers, when you look at the total numbers of those cohorts, they're pretty similar numbers.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Birth rates have been declining throughout human history, certainly for the last 300 or 400 years, rather dramatically. You go back to the early years of this country, the typical woman had 6 or 7 children. That comes down precipitously during the Industrial Revolution with increases, improvements in public health, in sanitation. People no longer felt they needed to have a lot of kids because they used to worry that they had to have a lot because not all of them would survive into adulthood. So, but the one period in over the last several hundred years where birth rates in this country not only didn't go down, they actually went up, was the so-called baby boom years. Right after World War II, the GIs come back home from the war. America is feeling great about itself. They get married, they have kids, and the typical woman in that 18 or 20-year period has 3 children, whereas the generation before, the typical woman only had 2, and every generation since, the typical woman only had 2. So there's this bulge, and the boomers made a lot of noise when we were young, and I'm one of them.
Mm-hmm.
They had to build extra schools for us, and we've made a lot of noise when we were young adults, the counterculture, and now we're very consequential as we turn old. The last thing I'll say about the size of the boomer generation is, so about 76 million boomers born in that 18-19-year stretch, from 46 to 64. Well, you know, now we're 40, 50 years later, the Grim Reaper comes along, and in fact, something like 11 million boomers have died. But you know what? There's still about 76 million Americans in that age cohort because there are 11 million immigrants in that age cohort. So the size of the boomer generation, curiously, is almost identical today to what it was 40 or 50 years ago.
And how does that compare to the millennials?
Well, the millennials will be the Xers, if you just want to move yourself down to the Xers of the generation between the boomers and millennials. They're only given credit for about 16 or 17 years. Were the baby busters. In millions, they're much smaller. They're only about 60 million.
Okay.
So the birth rates were down. They were a smaller generation. Birth rates have ticked back up a little bit, but the combination of birth rates and immigration has meant that the millennial generation, it's hard to assign a size to it because, again, we don't know the cutoff point. But assuming it's a 20-year generation, 18, 20 years, which is the way most other generations get defined, it is about an 80 million generation. So it's very close in size, maybe even a little bit larger than the boomers and our largest adult generation.
Okay. So 76 million boomers, 80 million or so millennials. That looks like balance to me. That looks like they're going to be replacing us one to one.
Well, and this is the nature of generational churn, and this is the way the life cycle happens. New people get born, they age into the electorate, they age into the workforce. The older generations complete the life cycle, and then the Grim Reaper arrives. And in some periods of our history, generational churn has not produced a great deal of fissures and stresses because young and old looked alike, they thought alike in many ways. In the moment we're in now, in part because of the racial and ethnic change you alluded to in your opening, driven mostly by the huge immigration wave of the last 40 or 50 years, young and old look completely different. I mean, we're on our way to becoming a, quote, majority-minority country. Half of all births today in this country are non-white. If you look at our youngest adult generation, the millennials, they're already more than 4 in 10. 43% are non-white. Our oldest generation, only 20% are non-white. We know through our history that different races, there are stresses around the simple difference in race, but also different races align differently in their political attitudes and their basic views towards government. So we have a young and old that don't look alike, they don't vote alike, they don't think alike, at a time when, because of the aging of the population, we do have to modernize the social compact of our big entitlement programs because they're on an unsustainable financial path.
Unsustainable, meaning there isn't the work there. There aren't going to be as many workers to support us as we get old.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, again, there's a long history here. I'll be concise. But when Social Security is now 75, almost 80 years old, it was the great creation of Franklin Roosevelt and the most successful domestic program we've ever had. That's not my opinion. That's the opinion of the American public. 9 in 10 Americans say Social Security and Medicare are good for the country. So, Franklin Roosevelt sort of introduced it along the notion, using language that we're familiar with from private pension plans. The government takes a little money from your paycheck every week. It puts it away. Maybe it earns a little bit of interest, and it returns it to you when you're ready to retire. And what could be a better program than that? And the American public very much likes it because it has that aspect to it. You contribute and then you get back benefits based on contributions you've made. There is some aspect of that in the program. There's no question about that. But much more so, Social Security is what actuaries call a pay-as-you-go program. So the benefits that today's retirees get are not so much based on what they put in back when they were workers. They are based on the taxes or contributions that today's workers are putting in. So today's retirees are supported by today's workers. And back at the beginning of Social Security, you literally had 20, 30, 40 workers per retiree. As the system matures and more people become beneficiaries, that number goes way down. It becomes 10 to 1, 5 to 1. It's now at about 3 to 1. And by the time all these baby boomers cross the threshold and go from being taxpayers and workers to being retirees, it'll be just 2 to 1. Oh. Well, at 2 to 1, the math doesn't work. And every year, the trustees of the Social Security program put out a report to the American public, and this is nonpartisan. This is a Democrat and a Republican. They're civil servants. They're not elected officials. And every year the report says, hey, guys, to the American public and to all the elected leaders, the math doesn't work. Social Security is going to be broke within less than 2 decades. Medicare is going to be broke in about 15 years. And we've got to do something about it. Now, it's a very hard thing to do about because this is so central to the lives of so many Americans. It's so important in terms of lifting people out of poverty. And the choices are pretty challenging, but that's what the math is the math, and you can't wish that away.
So millennials are thinking about this. This is on their minds. I'm wondering whether this is something millennials are actually thinking about, the fact that they're paying as we go now.
Right.
They don't see the payoff for them in the future. What does your research show there in terms of their understanding of that the equation?
Yeah. Well, it's a very good question. And are they thinking about it? Are they thinking about retirement security? The answer to that question is adults of all ages are thinking about retirement security. Indeed, just yesterday, I think Gallup, another very important public opinion survey research organization, put out an annual report on people's financial worries. And this year, as every year for the last decade they've been doing this, the number one financial worry for adults of all ages, starting from the youngest right to the oldest,
are, will I have enough money to retire on? That's a greater worry, for example, even than will I have enough money if I get sick? Mm-hmm. Or will I have enough money to get my kids through college and all the rest? Americans are concerned about all these things, but more than anything, they're concerned about retirement, including young adults, including millennials, even though for them retirement is far off in the distance. So we just asked millennials, we just did a survey of millennials a month or 6 weeks ago, and we said to them, do you think, with thinking about Social Security, do you think by the time you're ready to retire, will the benefits there be for you at current levels? Will they be for you at reduced levels, or will there be no Social Security benefits at all? Amazingly, just 6% said, I think it's going to be there for me at current levels. About 4 in 10 said, yeah, but only at reduced levels. And half said, it's not going to be there for me at all. It's really quite extraordinary because Social Security is something that even, you know, the other reality about these young adults, which you alluded to in your opening, is they're having a hard time in the economy. They've landed in the economy in a tough time with the recession, the slow recovery, the global changes in the economy. But so their incomes are actually lower than incomes of older adults were when they were at the same age. But the way Social Security works, of course, is that you pay taxes, you pay the payroll taxes on your first dollar. So in terms of the contributions to Social Security, it's actually a rather it is a regressive system. The highest rates are paid by people with the lowest incomes. Now, the genius of the system, and one of the reasons it's been so popular, is it's regressive going in, it's universal going in, but regressive. But it's supposed to be progressive coming out.
Right.
People at the lower end get the highest rate of return. And that's been a political and economic balancing act that, again, has worked very well for 70, 80 years. But it, too, is challenged by the changing demographics of the country.
Paul Taylor is our guest in this hour of midday, Executive Vice President of the Pew Research Center. Paul's written a book called The Next America: Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown, which lays out some very stark and sometimes disturbing differences between boomers, the ones who run things now, and the millennials they raised and nurtured. The oldest of those millennials are reaching their 30s, and as boomers retire and die off, millennial America will look and feel much different than today's America. We'll hear more from Paul Taylor in just a moment. You're welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780 or send us an email with a comment or question for Paul. That's midday@wypr.org. Taking a look at The Next America with Paul Taylor. That's the title of his book, The Next America: Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown, here on Midday. Dan Roderick's with you. And since I moved to Baltimore sometime in the 1970s, Paul, and saw the decline of industry here, I think specifically of Sparrows Point, the Bethlehem Steel Mill, and some other factories. I used to hear from folks who grew up around here that, you know, you didn't even have to finish high school in the old days, and you could still find a pretty decent job. Even a unionized job, decent wages, get you to the middle class pretty quickly. You could buy a house by the time you were 25 or 26. Someone introduced you to the right person down at the point. You got a decent job. You got in with the union, steelworkers union, maybe with the iron workers. Maybe you became a stevedore, a longshoreman. And we've seen the decline of those kinds of jobs over the years. It's become tougher for those who don't complete their education or only go as far as high school.
Yeah, you know, it sounds like the Bruce Springsteen song, My Hometown.
My Hometown.
Those jobs are going, boy, and they ain't coming back. So let me give you a few statistics on that, because what you say is absolutely true, and you can see it in the numbers. We did a report put out about a month ago, and we called it The Rising Cost of Not Going to College.
And it focused on the economic circumstances of the oldest of the millennial generations. We looked at 25 to 33-year-olds. So presumably, they were at an age when they were through with their formal education into the workforce. And we could take a look at their economic circumstances. What's their employment rate? What's their unemployment rate? What are their wages? What are their debt? What's their poverty level and all the rest? To start with, and here's what we know about this generation. First of all, they're the best educated generation in our history. Of that age cohort, about a third had a BA degree or more. If you go back to older groups, you know, it was closer to a quarter. So this is a group that has gone on to college at higher levels. But to stay with the college-going part of the group, it's a very well-known and familiar story. The burden of student loan debt. So today's 25 to 34-year-olds are much more likely, if they with a BA degree, a much higher share, about two-thirds, have some college loan debt, and the median college loan debt is about $28,000. You go back a generation, and fewer had debt, only about half had debt, and it was only about $15,000. So there's no question that if you get a college degree, you start with this albatross around your neck. There's now more student loan debt out there than credit card debt. There's more than $1 trillion worth of student loan debt out there. Nevertheless, those folks have made an investment. If you ask them, even in their current circumstances, you think this was a good investment or not, 85% say yes. Either it's already paid off or I'm sure that it will. And when you do analyses of the lifetime earnings by education, that is supported. So then you look at the if you look at current circumstances, if you look at the contrast in unemployment rates between 25 to 33-year-olds who have a college degree and those who don't, the college degree kids have an unemployment rate, as the most recent numbers, 3.8%. Kids without a college degree in that same age group, 12%. What you see is, and across all other economic indicators, if you haven't gone past high school, you pay a much, much stiffer penalty than your parents' generation did, for exactly the reason you described. It's now much more a knowledge-based economy than it was a generation or two ago. The big factory jobs are gone. Some of the white-collar clerical jobs that you could do without an advanced degree are been replaced by computers, increasingly by robots. This is the new reality. This is the new nature of the workforce and nature of the economy. And the story of income inequality, which has become a more familiar story now among the entire population, and we're paying more attention to it as a society, you can see it very dramatically just within this age cohort. The differences between economic circumstances by education are the largest they've ever been.
And you can almost taste the resentment of someone in that situation, Paul, who finds that the promise isn't there, spends a long time looking for a job, finally gets a job, gets a paycheck, and then sees the deduction for what is this FICA thing? Am I taken out of my paycheck? What is that for? I could see it happening.
Well, we can stay with the economics of it, but the impact of the difficulties that young adults have getting started, getting themselves an economic foundation, plays out across a number of other realms, and I deal with this in the book, and we deal with this in this most recent report on millennials. Take a look at the marriage rate. Here's a dramatic change. If you look at millennials, 18 to 32s, when we did this last year, in 2013, just 26% of 18 to 32-year-olds were married. If you go back to the boomer generation, about double that number were married. If you go back to the generation even older than that, nearly two-thirds were married. So marriage, has been put off. The average age of first marriage over the last 40 or 50 years has risen by 6 years for both men and women. And when we ask millennials, unmarried millennials, would you like to marry one day? Overwhelmingly, 70% say yes. Then we say, well, why? What's holding you back? And the most prevalent response is, I'm not a good potential spouse. I don't have a job. I don't have a career. I don't have an economic foundation. I can't be a good provider. Well, one of the difficulties there is that throughout human history, marriage has been a very successful economic arrangement. Two can live more cheaply than one. You share resources.
You can buy a house.
You can buy a house. You pool your money. marriage throughout history has been the most successful form, the most successful way to have children and raise children. Millennials haven't stopped having children. So a rising share of their kids are born outside of marriage. And while there are plenty of single parents who do heroic work in raising kids, I think most people recognize, and the social science supports the notion, this is a tougher way to raise a kid economically and in other ways. So you've got kind of a cycle that reinforces itself. I don't have a job. I don't have good economic prospects. I don't get married. Not getting married and having kids when you're not married kind of reinforces this cycle. And you don't see this among all millennials, but you see it among a very large share of millennials, which is a troubling sign for sort of the well-being of them and, frankly, of their children.
Paul Taylor, our guest on Midday, Executive Vice President of the Pew Research Center, where he oversees demographic, social, and generational research. His book, The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. Paul, some of our listeners have questions about Social Security specifically across this generational divide. So we'll go back to that subject. Let's start with Sharon with a question for you. Sharon's in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, Dan. It's nice to be with you. I had a question for Mr. Taylor and also a statement. I wondered when he was talking about the funding gap in Social Security, why he did not mention the trust fund, which was created as part of the 1986 Social Security reform. That reform increased taxes in FICA and the retirement age. I'm at the very end of the boomer cohort. I was born in 61. And instead of retiring at 65, the way my older boomer cohort retiring, I retire at 67. I've also paid more in terms of FICA. Mm-hmm. And that money has gone into a trust fund, which is supposed to help close that gap. The other thing I would say is that you can simply end the problem with this gap by lifting the cap on wages subject to FICA. Mark Begich and Tom Harkin have a Senate bill that does precisely that.
Okay, let's hear from Paul on that.
Sure. Well, you're absolutely right about the history. There was the last time Social Security faced a big fiscal crisis was in the early 80s. That one, unlike this one, which is driven by long-term demographics, that one was driven by shorter-term cyclical recession. There was high unemployment. There was high inflation, kind of the worst of all worlds for Social Security. So with high unemployment, fewer payroll taxes were coming in. With high inflation, the COLA adjustments were going up. And they suddenly found themselves, my goodness, we're not going to be able to write the checks. So they did a big fix. And this is sort of, in this era of gridlock government, this is sort of a famous moment. Famously, they had a commission. Alan Greenspan was the head of the commission. But it was Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill that ultimately blessed that from both sides of the partisan aisle. And you have it exactly right. They gradually raised the retirement age. They made some other funding fixes that beefed up the trust funds in ways that began to take care of the demographic challenge. But if you go back even then, and when people wrote about that and they said, this is going to take care of our problem for the next 30 years or so, but we still have a big, big problem looming on the horizon when the boomers start to retire. And that's where we are now. That trust fund was built up several trillion dollars worth. But in the last 3 or 4 years, the revenues that come into the system are not as great as the payments that go out. So we're starting now to deplete the trust fund. And by the year 2030, which is, 18, 19 years from now, 2033, I think the latest estimate is, that trust fund will be entirely depleted. And at that point, all you have left to pay the checks are current contributions year in and year out. And that, according to the Social Security trustees, pays only about 3/4 of the benefit. So at that point, you've hit a wall. What the trustees say is somewhat similar to what they did 30 years ago, is don't wait till we get to the crisis, because if you wait till we get to the crisis, the burden of the solution is going to have to fall on future beneficiaries or future taxpayers. We can see this problem from here. Why not institute some sort of gradual fix that spreads the pain among all the stakeholders. Now, you suggest one fix, which a lot of people support, which is the notion of lifting the cap. The way the system currently works, as I mentioned earlier, it's regressive. It comes on your first dollars, but it only goes up to, I think the latest number is $117,000. Beyond that, you don't pay any. Now, that goes back to the original paradigm that Franklin Roosevelt proposed, that there should be some connection between what you pay in contributions and what you get back in benefits. And he didn't want unlimited huge benefits for very wealthy people, so he said, well, I'm going to have some sort of cutoff. A lot of people believe that the cutoff is too low and should be raised. That's one of many, many potential solutions. And I'm not a policy expert, and nor do I want to get in the thick of which is the best one. but what I do believe is if you take this on from the point of view of generational equity, if you believe that societies like families are a compact between the generations, what you really have to do is take this on sooner rather than later. The truth is that the Social Security for the first 70 or 80 years has been a great deal for the first generation. It was a little bit not quite as good for the next generation. The boomers are going to come out about even if you add up, and every personal circumstance is different. But if you add it up on a generational component, if you look at both Social Security and Medicare, and you add up all the taxes that the boomer generation have paid to those two programs and all the benefits that they'll get back from those two programs projected forward with the usual kind of actuarial calculations, the boomers are going to come out roughly even. Folks older than the boomers will have gotten something on the order of $15 to $20 trillion more. That's T with a T, trillion dollars more, right, in benefits than they paid in taxes. And today's 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds and 15-year-olds will get back trillions less than they paid. So in the broadest sense, there is a question of generational equity here, and we're leaving our children and grandchildren with a much, much less secure future retirement than the ones that we'll have to enjoy. And shouldn't we as a society do something about that?
Paul, I want to share a tweet that came in from Chris, one of our listeners, who says, "Irony, no generation has done more to imperil, raid, and weaken social welfare than the boomers who fret they won't get their Social Security." Now, I tweeted back, "Chris, how old are you?" And he replies, 33, old enough to remember Reagan-era welfare demonizing and Clinton-era appeasement, meaning talking about welfare reform there in the 90s with Clinton. So there's a little bit of generational resentment for you.
Yeah, you know, one of the points I make in the book is that there isn't that much generational resentment, despite the very real gaps, both in the racial and ethnic profile, as I described, in their political voting. The book goes into the fact that if you look at the last two presidential elections, the gap between how young and old voted are the largest in our history. So despite some very real, and it's certainly going to the realm of technology and what people are comfortable with and some of the social issues, whether it's gay marriage, marijuana, you can march across a whole lot of realms and find that the generations in today's America are different across all of them. But you can also find the following. If you look in the realm that most people intersect with other generations and care most about and is most central to their lives, it is their families. And in that realm, you see plenty of evidence that there is more generational interdependence and good vibrations, if you will, than anything we have known. I'm a boomer. I came of age in the 60s. There was a counterculture. There was a kind of never trust anybody over 30 was one of the rallying cries.
Right.
We were pretty certain that our parents and grandparents had screwed up just about everything in our country, and thank God we had come along to make it right. If you look at today's young adults, who in many ways, you know, have been dealt a much worse hand, certainly with the economy, than we were dealt with 30, 40 years ago, and they get it, but there's no finger being pointed. You can find some of this, and you quoted one tweet to that effect, but you know, you see very little of this in the public discourse. You know, one thing that's happened in these bad economies, and the book goes into this in some detail, is that the young adults, the millennials, have boomeranged back home. to live with mom and dad.
Like 40% of them.
Yeah, exactly. If you're 25, 28, 30 years old and, you know, you can't find a job or you're flipping burgers or you're at an unpaid internship, you know, you're not married, what do you do to make ends meet? Well, turns out, you know, going back to live with mom and dad, you know, the refrigerator is stocked. You don't have to put coins into the washing machine. And, oddly, and I say this, yeah. I loved my parents, but boy, when I was, the minute I got out of school, I was ready to go on. For a lot of these families, you kind of migrate from being the child to being the roommate, and they share a lot of the same tastes in music, and they kind of hang out. And this is families being resilient. This is families caring for each other across the generational divide. And even at a time when the family itself is an institution that has been buffeted by a lot of change, births outside of marriage, divorce rates, and all the rest, people, you know, even in its new forms and its changing forms, family is the original social safety net. It has been called upon, particularly with the hard economy of the last 6 or 8 years, to play that role. Literally, young adults moving in or back in with their folks. In some cases, it's middle-aged adults moving in with their elderly folks. When we had those high unemployment rates, when we had those high foreclosures as the housing market burst, you had a lot of 40 and 50-somethings. Where do you go when everything is crapped out for you? Well, maybe you have a brother-in-law. Maybe you have a 70-year-old parent. And it works the other way as well. Maybe a 75-year-old widow falls down and breaks her leg and doesn't want to go into a nursing home, so she moves in with the middle-aged parent. There is more of this living together across generational lines, helping people out. This is clearly on the increase. I guess the last thing I'll say about that is if you go back to the beginnings of time, the generational sort of compact between young and old was very simple. I take care of you when you're young, and one reason I have you is you'll be around to take care of me when I'm old. In the modern era, in part because of the great success of Social Security and Medicare, the truth is that there are a lot of 60, 70, and 80-year-olds who actually don't need their grown children to take care of them, and everybody is thrilled with that. The 80-year-old is thrilled not to be a burden. The 50-year-old is thrilled, I love you, Grandma, you know, let's see the kids, but I'm going home, you know, we'll visit on Sunday and that sort of thing. Basically, that's worked very well. But economic stress is changing that, and interestingly, it tends to be the 70 and 80-year-olds who are still doing more to help their children and their grandchildren than the other way around. Because the other change in our society, we talked about this a little bit earlier, is it's not just that we're getting older as a society; it's that the money in the society, in the households, has migrated up the family tree. So a lot of the money is parked with the 60 and 70 and 80-year-olds. Eventually, presumably, when they die, they'll be bequests, and it'll filter its way down to the boomers and the Xers. But right now, there's a lot of money there. There's actually a lot of relative well-being there, even though everybody is stressed about retirement. And people do what people do. You don't have, you know, families aren't means tested. You don't have to pass a regulation that says inside a family, if somebody is in trouble, you're supposed to help. People sort of get that. They know that memo and they live it. And that's one reason why it seems to me there's not a lot of friction across the generations, because in people's family lives, people help each other across the generations.
Generations are more different from each other now than at any time in living memory. Paul Taylor deals with that in his book, The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment on Midday. You can reach us by calling 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. A short break. We'll be right back. And this is Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Paul Taylor joining us in this hour of the show, Executive Vice President at the Pew Research Center. And his book, The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. Paul, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the Affordable Care Act and how this the phenomenons that you're dealing with in your research here and your writing play out when it comes to Obamacare. The millennials heard a lot about how they need to get insurance, the young invincibles, in part because, I guess they heard this, that we need them in the system in order to pay for this full rollout of this program over the next 10 and 20 years. So what do you see there? Do you see resentment in that, or do millennials see that they're getting something for this?
It's hard to know. I mean, obviously, it's been such a dominant political story over the last year, really over the last several years, but it certainly came to a head in the last 6 months or so with the rollout of the program and all the difficulties with the website. And now, you know, a little bit of crowing from the Obama administration, we hit our mark. And some skepticism, well, did they really hit their mark? Did they get enough young adults? And from what I read in the papers, it looks like they got pretty close to what they were shooting for. I think this is so new that it's very difficult to know how this is going to play out. But your broader point is right. Part of the whole success and premise of a social insurance system is a large pool that includes healthy people and unhealthy people. And you balance it all that out, and only a big government or a big provider can then get rates that that are affordable across the board. That's the goal. I think it'll be probably several years before we know whether it has succeeded. But there are aspects of Obamacare that have been in place for a while now, including the one that went into place a few years ago, which is young adults could stay in their parents' program up until they're age 26. And that clearly had an impact on the well-being of, you know, a substantial number of young adults. So, but this one, I think, is still a work in progress. A lot of numbers floating around on what it all means. I'm not smart enough to know. I'm watching with interest.
Okay. Another thing I wanted to ask you about when it comes to the young adults, some of the characteristics here of the millennials, maybe not opposed to big government, maybe can see the benefits of something like the ACA. Social Security, Medicare, not necessarily opposed, but also sort of a libertarian streak, entrepreneurial, don't expect to be in the same company, the same job for very long, a little more free-spirited, willing to take risks, maybe. What does all that portend for the sort of solidarity and cohesiveness you need in a society that we're all in this together? Attitude that, helped the baby boom generation and the one before that?
Well, it's a great question. And again, I don't want to stretch my credentials or suggest that I'm a seer who can look into the future. But here are a few things we do know. And this notion of are we all in it together, and how does a generation cohere? How does the society cohere? One of the interesting things about millennials is, as you point out, those who are now in the electorate and voting, they've been in two or three national elections now, and they're very clear. They're very democratic in their voting. Certainly the two Obama elections, they stood out very much so. And in their political attitudes, they align on the liberal end in almost every measure that we look at. But if you ask, we ask adults of all ages, what do you consider yourself, a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent? Fully half of millennials say independent. This is much more than any other older generation, and it's much more than any generation we've ever seen. So there is a sense of not being attached to traditional anchor institutions of society. We see the exact same pattern when we ask another standard question. We ask people about their religious affiliation. And what are you? You know, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Hindu, Muslim, et cetera, et cetera. 30% of millennials, again, the highest number we've ever seen, say, I'm nothing in particular. It doesn't mean they're agnostic or atheist. It just means they don't choose to affiliate with any religion. And then, as I mentioned earlier, another core social institution of society that sort of tends to create cohesiveness and a sense of participation and belonging is marriage. And only about a quarter of millennials are married. And if you go to their parents' and grandparents' generation, those figures were half and two-thirds. So what is it? How do millennials navigate their lives when they are choosing not to engage or be somewhat unmoored from traditional anchor institutions? Well, the answer is very clear. They are the first generation of digital natives. They haven't had to adapt to these amazing little things we all hold in our hands now. And we click it three times and we have access to the entire sum of human knowledge. And frankly, if it takes a third click, you're a little bit annoyed. What's taking so long, right? Now, somebody my age, and used to be a newspaper reporter, my jaw drops at the access to information
instantaneous in wherever I am that I have. Somebody who's 18, 20, 25, it's the only world he or she has ever known. And it's not just information acquisition that one gets from this this little device and gadget. It's social interaction. It's building social networks. And somebody more clever than me described this generation of millennials as a pre-Copernican generation, because truly the universe can revolve around them, because they go on their social media sites and they go on Facebook and they build huge networks of friends and their friends and they their affinity groups and they're maybe their colleagues, they're this and that, but they get to build their networks and they get to place themselves at the center of their networks, and they take their selfies and they share the as much intimate details of their lives as they choose. And by the way, 9 in 10 say most people share a little bit too much on the internet. But it is their indispensable tool for social interaction, for a sense of belonging. And again, I think it's an open question. Are those relationships? So the typical millennial on Facebook, many more millennials than any other generation are on Facebook, and the typical millennial on Facebook has 250 friends. The typical older person on Facebook has 50 friends. Well, discuss among yourselves. Has there been a quantum leap in human friendliness, you know, over the last generation or two? Or is there just something different about the way young adults engage with other people and use these new technologies? Obviously, it's the latter. So what does that portend for the kinds of citizens they'll be, for the kinds of employees they'll be? Again, I wouldn't want to push this too far, because I think the answer is we don't fully know. I do think that those people who study the psychology of this generation, including kind of people in the human resources field who have to understand kind of what makes them tick as employees or future employees, and teachers who have observed them, you know, throughout their young lives, I think there's a general consensus that they are a consensual, they're a get-along-well generation, plays nicely. You know, remember, we got our grades in kindergarten, plays nicely with others. They are a plays nicely with other generation. I think some of that just may be the nature of how much interaction they have all the time with others. But here's another aspect that we highlighted in a recent report. They tend to have a dim view of human nature. Interestingly, there's a classic question that we and others ask about social trust, and it goes something I think is almost word for word. Generally speaking, would you say most people can be trusted, or you can't be too careful when you're dealing with other people? Only 19% of millennials say most people can be trusted, which is only about half the level that older adults say. So there is something. It's a really interesting question. Why? One possibility is, as we mentioned earlier, a higher share of this generation are minorities, a higher share at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. And one of the things that sociologists have observed with this question is people who feel vulnerable for whatever reason, whether they're a minority or whether they don't have much money, tend to have lower levels of social trust because they're less well fortified to deal with the consequences of misplaced trust. So there's a wariness about this generation towards others that will be interesting to watch. But anyway, it's a complicated generation. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I understand all of it, and I'm very aware of the fact that I am not among the generation. I'm a distant observer and may be missing some of the most important cues.
Hey, Paul, I want to close by reading this email from Ken and get your quick comment on it. We've got about 2 minutes left in our hour together. Ken says, "Don't you think there have been overwhelming difficulties with any generation? You make it sound as though the millennials will have it more difficult than other generations and are more likely to fail. I think we millennials will adapt just as any other generation did, and we will survive and end up thriving."
Well, not only is that a great sentiment, but that is a sentiment shared by the overwhelming majority of his fellow millennials. So when we ask people of all adults of all generations, "Do you have enough money currently to live the life you want?" Millennials at lower levels than anybody else say, "Yeah." So older adults are much more likely to say yes. When we ask them, "Well, do you think you will eventually have enough money to live the life you want?" Millennials lead all their elders in saying, "Yes, it's going to all work out fine." Now, some of this may simply be the invincibility of youth. They're young. What do they know? But but frankly, if that's what it is, thank God it's there, because that optimism is frankly hardwired into the American character. And I think the point is exactly right. Of course, all generations face challenges. And there are some, you go back to the depressions, you go back to wars. You know, there are a lot of difficulties that every generation faces. So this is this generation's burden to bear, and I would say that burden is mostly an economic burden. But the internet, the digital revolution, explodes with possibilities, and this generation, it seems to me, psychologically is very well attuned and oriented towards leading us into the digital era, writing the rules for it, finding its way, and with their optimism can be self-fulfilling. So God bless them, and Godspeed.
Paul Taylor, I've enjoyed having you as our guest in this hour of midday. Thank you so much.
Been my pleasure.
Paul Taylor with the Pew Research Center. His book again, The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. Dan Rodrigues here. I hope you enjoyed our program. See you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.